You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Michael Amy. Michael, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for welcoming me.
Let's talk about what you're working on right now. What is it that you're involved with, or your project at the moment?
Well, right now I'm in transition. I'm moving back from contemporary art into the Renaissance. I'm working on a long article, which will take me some years to write up, considering all of my teaching obligations and family obligations. It's an article on Cimabue, who is an Italian painter, a rather mythical Italian painter, active towards the end or the last quarter of the 13th century, so the Duecento in Italian. And I'm working on a series of altarpieces he painted for the upper church of San Francesco at Assisi, and looking at the impact these paintings had upon the development of Renaissance altarpieces, or the extent to which these frescoed altarpieces by Cimabue kind of prefigure subsequent developments in altarpiece design.
And you said you're studying pieces in Assisi. Is that correct?
Yes. In the upper church and the transept, you have two large crucifixion frescoes, which are altarpieces. They stand above altars, although almost everyone overlooks this. And they're very interesting in format. They're monumental. They're very large. And they show narrative, the crucifixion, on a grand monumental scale. And additionally, the format is perfectly rectangular. It's a large horizontal rectangular field, and that is a prefiguration of the unified altarpiece of the late 15th, early 16th century. And the rest is history, of course. Think of course, the Great Last Judgment by Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel, which is likewise a frescoed altarpiece.
Right, right, right. And I know you're really considered an expert in Michelangelo, and which was really my introduction to the art world. When I was 16, seeing Michelangelo in Florence and understanding the art through that lens, which is quite magnificent. But I'd like to talk a little bit more about this article that you're working on, because I don't know a lot about Cimabue. You mentioned that he was almost kind of mythical. Can you tell me a little more about him? There seems to be influences by painters that are hard to put a finger on, but I'm sure you could. I remember when I saw, I think it was Fra Angelico frescoes in Fiesole somewhere. I don't know if you know those, but they seem to have a kind of almost surreal quality to me, like a real departure. And I don't want to belabor this point too much, but I'm just trying to ask, what are some of the qualities that Cimabue is bringing to this that perhaps touch on I don't know if it was mythical, the word you said before, or was it?
Yes, because actually his oeuvre, I think, is rather controversial, since there's very little tangible evidence as far as what he painted is concerned. I'm not working on attribution, so I haven't looked deeply into that aspect. But I think the only, if memory serves, the only signed work we have by Cimabue is a much restored mosaic fragment, I think it's in Pisa, around which an oeuvre has been built. Cimabue is significantly the artist who is mentioned in the first edition of Vasari's very famous Lives of the Artists, the Lives of the Great Italian Painters, Sculptors, and Architects. The first edition of 1550, which was published in Florence, mentions Cimabue in the title of the work. So Cimabue is the beginning of it all. Cimabue is an artist who worked in, what was happening then in Italy was, the dominant school of painting was the Tuscan Byzantine school of painting, These were ideas coming from the East, as people were fleeing the East and returning to Europe as Muslims were seizing more and more domain in what was the Byzantine realm. So you had all of this ancient learning, this Greek learning, that was coming back to the West. And, of course, these were Christians, so they wanted to come close to Rome, and they were, you know, patrons, but patrons and painters were coming back from the East to Italy, and thus you have this Byzantine tradition that is implemented there. And Cimabue creates a, you know, you clearly see the Byzantine roots of his work, but it's a more lyrical work. It is less stylized. It is more mellifluous. There's somewhat greater naturalism, somewhat greater better understanding of transitions from foreground to middle ground to background. There's greater volume. The color transitions are more subtle and less glaring. So Vasari recognized this. Vasari was, of course, you know, our first great art critic, and he was a very, very successful painter and a wonderful architect, as you know, and
yes,
a great writer. I mean, he's most famous for his book, which is a wonderful read.
Absolutely, and I mean, it's fascinating, and I kind of want to stay with Cimabue because you're putting so much energy into this, and seems like such a fascinating case, and there's all these formal contributions that he's made, as you're describing, and I'm sure as Vasari describes. And what else is influencing him? Is there, if I know this may seem a little intangible, but what else is influencing the work or gives it a poetic quality? I mean, there's something about Michelangelo, right? He does all these wonderful formal things, but there's something else that's extraordinary
of ideas that are coming back from the East, ideas that were lost in the West. A lot of learning was coming back. You know, you also have St. Francis, this great cycle by Cimabue, well, these two altarpieces, and then also he and his school produce a cycle in the apse of this church, which was directly under the patronage of the Pope. This church stands above the site where Francis lies buried, and Francis emphasized the importance of nature. He was almost an environmentalist. He embraced nature. He has this marvelous sonnet addressed to the sun and to the moon, and there's a famous scene of Francis preaching to the birds. So I think his emphasis upon nature is important. And when you go to Assisi, you see cycles of frescoes in which naturalism, the transitions over the course of half a century from a very severe, flat, archaic Tuscan Byzantine style to the frescoes from the cycle of frescoes from the life of Francis, in which you have remarkable depictions of architecture, of three-dimensional bodies, you know, massive bodies, volumes in space, the way they inhabit space and they articulate space, I think has a lot to do with Francis. Also, of course, there's the Council of the Church around 1215, which emphasized the importance of Christ incarnate. So this emphasis upon Christ, the Word, assuming the flesh, so that Christ can be sacrificed upon the cross for the redemption of mankind, which is what Christians believe. And I think that directs people's attention towards the human nature of Christ, and thus towards the body of men, and the emotions of men, and the talents of men, their intellectual capacities, their individuality. And I think all of these things that are happening in the 13th century help to kickstart the Renaissance.
Well, absolutely. It seems, you know, as you say that, it seems so hard to imagine, you know, getting into the the mind of someone living at that time and understanding from an artist's point of view how religious thought, someone like Saint Francis is perceived. I mean, it's almost I understand that it's, you know, that then Saint Francis, I mean, obviously much earlier, there's this saint, there's these mystical happenings. There was more than the way we perceive the world. That kind of religion infused, or that kind of thinking infused with daily life, I would think also influences artists in a way that's hard for us to even imagine.
Yes, the intensity of that engagement with nature. Very interestingly, Cimabue was claimed by Vasari to be, the teacher of Giotto, who is considered universally one of the greatest painters in the Western canon, and the founding father of the Florentine school of painting. Vasari was in the employ of the Duke, Cosimo de' Medici, and thus Vasari has a Florentine agenda, which is very clear in his great book, The Lives of the Artists. Interestingly, Dante Alighieri, in his great poem, The Divine Comedy, known as The Comedy back then, states that Cimabue's fame is eclipsed by the fame of Giotto, this rising star. So we have here all kinds of topoi, which we find today, you know, in the art world as well, which is fascinating to me.
Right, and everybody thinks that's new. You know, we don't often hear about that. I guess it's only through the lens of Vasari that we do. I remember hearing about disputes between Michelangelo
and the art world. It's fickle.
And, I mean, the political gains then, or the infighting seems
that's
to be
correct.
Similar to the art world now. You know, artists getting maybe commissions they didn't want, but, you know, it's the Pope or this or that, you know. It's kind of incredible to think that was happening then.
Yeah.
And so this is an exciting article. When do you imagine it finished? It sounds like a real work of love, of passion.
When I find the time, I need a large block of time for these kinds of articles. I need to have access to a good research library, which is not easy up here in Rochester, where I'm calling from. So that is why I do a lot of work also in modern and contemporary art, because in those areas I write smaller pieces that involve much less research or sometimes hardly any research. So really my interest in these two very different domains kind of feed into each other, I think.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because we're talking about you know very early work, and that fascinates me. I could really talk about that for a while, but then maybe we should talk now about the role of the critic today. And the equivalent of Vasari today. What is the role of the critic today? Everybody says something different that I talk to, whether it's Robert Storr critiquing other critics or other critics talking about the various ways to approach things. In the context of Vasari and the kind of leap we were just about to make from the Renaissance to now, what do you see as the current iteration of that, or where are we at in terms of criticism?
I think our role is to make sense of what we're seeing, to try to understand what the work is about. We're facing a chaotic situation. We're facing a situation that is unexpected. That's at least what I hope. I'd like to be shocked by the new and see where it comes from. I have a historical perspective, and I like to figure out, you know, what are the roots behind what I'm seeing in today's practice. And I like to see the big picture, so I'll give a kind of, you know, historical overview, which not many critics do, because as Robert Storr had stated in his interview, which I found to be very interesting, he says that many of our critics are not trained as art historians, which is good. I think we want different people at the table. We have very distinguished critics who are poets, And that is, of course, a longstanding tradition. We have very distinguished critics who are practicing artists, and that, of course, goes back to Vasari, who was a very famous and celebrated artist in his day, and really a tastemaker, by the way. He gave the thumbs up, a project was approved by the Duke in Florence, and if he gave the thumbs down, it did not fly. Michelangelo was a very famous critic as well, in a sense. He killed projects just by giving a thumbs down. When he came back to Florence in 1516 and saw a gallery that was built on the exterior of the Cathedral of Florence, just underneath the dome, thus across Brunelleschi's, just underneath Brunelleschi's dome, across one face of the drum, the octagonal drum of the cathedral, Michelangelo famously said it resembles a cage for crickets, and that was the death of that project. You can still see that eighth of a gallery standing there, worked by Baccio Dagnolo, on that face of the cathedral.
Amazing.
So I think what I bring to the table is my passion for a wide variety of arts. In the Western tradition, which I am well acquainted with, but also an openness to other traditions. When I'm at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I was there 2 days ago. I just spent some time in the Rockefeller wing looking at an exhibition of African sculpture that is coming down very soon. Just that world of forms intrigues me. And I think I bring openness to the table. I work on very different subjects in contemporary art, or at least I hope I do.
Well, and you're coming at it through the lens of historical, through history, through art history. I mean, that is, in a sense, your lens, correct? You're giving context and understanding. Is it also for the artist a kind of checks and balances system, or do you see criticism that way? You know, it's kind of
I think we have to express judgments, which we're not always encouraged to do. Sometimes when I've expressed judgments in reviews, if those reviews turned out to be negative, that was toned down, or that part of the review was eliminated once I saw it published. But I think I agree with Jerry Saltz in that regard, and sometimes we have discussions about this. But yes, I think we have to underscore what is important, and if we're disappointed with a project, we should say so.
But you said you agree with Jerry Saltz on that and had many discussions about what
exactly. Well, a couple of times after.
The critics saying something.
Well, after talks that he gave, I remember one at CAA and one on another occasion, I approached him and said, you know, you have opportunities that are not given to every critic to express yourself clearly as possible. I remember that my mandate at one magazine was to engage in formalist criticism, to describe the works of art, and Jerry finds this very tedious to read, which is very often so, I agree, not always, but very often so. Again, you know, writers at a certain magazine were not encouraged to state point blank how good or how poor, well, certainly how poor the exhibition was. And I certainly don't go out to find exhibitions that I find to be weak. That was something Hilton Kramer engaged in, and I find on that's too easy. We can, you know, for every great exhibition or every good exhibition I see 10 or 15 I don't care about. It doesn't mean I'm right not to care about those. But I like the challenge of going out to find something that is good and explaining why this merits our attention.
And that's certainly the kind of writing I like reading, and I like reading your writing.
Brandon, may I add something?
Sure.
Yes, I think also too many critics today are over-specialized. I was told by a couple of my editors that, again, I bring, you know, this openness to the table, but also this engagement with, you know, the modernist tradition, with the avant-garde, and also, of course, with old master practice that precedes it. I have that big perspective, which fewer and fewer people have who engage in art criticism today. You have people who know in a huge amount about, let's say, the Fluxus movement, or about the conceptual art of the 70s, but barely know anything about Cubism or Surrealism, which is problematic, I think.
I think that is problematic. I mean, when you're looking at contemporary work and writing about it in the context of history, does it matter to you that the artist may not even be aware of some of that history? Because we know artists are, you know, new artists are creating work and aren't necessarily aware of the histories that came before them, though it is coming out of those histories, clearly.
Yes, I don't think they're working in a vacuum at all. This is an ongoing visual tradition. I mean, it's amazing when you know, I teach the survey of Western art, going from prehistory, so about 25,000 years before the Common Era, up to Picasso in the 1930s. That's a year-long class. It's amazing to see, you know, that all these traditions that we're still practicing today are so very old, you know, dealing with the body, with landscape, modeling, carving, you know, drawing, adding, you know, tonal transitions, color, of course. All of that was already done. So this is an ongoing dialogue, I believe. And I'm quite certain about it. And what did I want to say? Now I'm losing my train of thought.
That's okay, because I can edit this out too, so you can,
had artists who come back to me after reading a catalog essay I've written for them or for their gallery, or after I've reviewed their exhibition, and they say the scales have dropped off of their eyes, so to speak. They're seeing now things in their work that they did not know were there, and they're in agreement with me. They didn't think of these things, but indeed they realize that there's a lot of truth to what I'm stating, and that this is of value to them.
Enormously important to me. That seems enormously important to me. That seems that you're really hitting on something then, and sorry to interrupt, because you're reading it for the artist as well as the audience.
Yes, I'm, again, thinking of my audience. I like to write for different audiences. I like to write for an intelligent audience, but with a language that is as clear as I can possibly write. You know, kind of, I'm always thinking of the kind of audience that reads the New York Times, an audience of non-specialists, but people who are interested in ideas, who are curious about the world. And thus, yes, I write for artists, and I write for a public, a diverse public, I hope.
Well, I think you do. I look forward to one day seeing your article on Tima Bui, and I wish you the best with your work. I want to thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you, Brainerd. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.